This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, February 2nd, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. What are the widely held beliefs about foreign policy, about the interactions of nations that lead us astray when considering potential military action? Richard Tenania is author of the new book Public Choice Theory and the Illusion of Grand Strategy, where he argues that the public choice perspective is key to understanding the most important aspects of American foreign policy.
For people who don't follow foreign policy debates about foreign policy studies very closely, we should probably do some preview like you do in your book. And so briefly describe the unitary actor model and why you think it doesn't hold up.
So in international relations, the unitary actor model is basically that you treat states as independent actors and you build your model based on that. So it's analogous and, you know, borrowed from economics, where in microeconomics, you take the individual, you assume the individual is rational, and then you predict a lot, you know, you predict things about the world and you try to explain the world from that perspective. So in international relations, this is basically our starting point. It's not, you know, for everybody, though the field is very diverse and there's a lot of, you know, debates about different things. But basically, if you're going to say, you know, international relations is based on one thing that makes it different from, you know, anything else in political science, it's the states as unitary actors. This means they have, you can talk about states like you talk about an individual. They have goals, they have strategies, they have things they want to accomplish and ways that they go about trying to accomplish them. You know, they're rational in the economic sense. And so my argument in the book is that this is not a good model. I mean, it's like all models, it's imperfect. As even people who subscribe to the model would say, it describes the world in some ways and certainly doesn't describe the world in other ways. And I guess this is my disagreement with a lot of the field is I think it's much less useful than they think it is. I think we understand foreign policy in a different way. In a different way.
So to the extent that people, and you, obviously you have a reason for pointing this out, why does acceptance of that model lead you astray when evaluating the interactions of countries when it comes to our foreign policy?
So I have the theoretical chapter in the book, and then I have chapters on different parts of American foreign policy. So I go through them and I say, you know, what would a unitary actor model or actually a grand strategy predict? Grand strategy defined as some incorporation between economic tools, military tools, and diplomatic tools in the service of certain goals. So I ask whether a grand strategy model or more of a public choice model where we relax the unitary actor model explains various parts of foreign policy. And I argue that in area after area, the latter approach works better. So if you ask, why did the U.S. go to Iraq? What was it trying to accomplish in Afghanistan? I mean, the answer is probably not much. I mean, there were short-term political decisions made based on certain beliefs and ideas and political interests of the actors involved. And some actors involved had ideological interests, but there was no person at the top making everything the U.S. government was doing cohere. Economic sanctions the same way. How we deal with rival powers is the same way. So yeah, this is sort of the heart of the book.
Compare and contrast here. I'm going to get a little off track. Compare and contrast here. The U.S. Congress decides to go to war, and U.S. Congress decides to create a new entitlement program. It seems to me that in both cases there are a lot of upfront costs, and maybe the people who are in office making that decision aren't particularly concerned about the longer term.
Yes. I mean, that's the libertarian perspective, and I think it's clearly right. Congress doesn't really declare war much anymore. I mean, not even in Iraq. They had a vote to authorize force, but it really wasn't a declaration of war. So that pretty much never happens. But the idea is the same. The president decides to commit troops to a certain region, and you know, people are selected to leadership positions in the government not based on their ability to achieve long term goals. They're selected because they're good at short-term politics. So of course, why would we be surprised by the fact that they're not good at, say, building a democracy in Afghanistan or Iraq? They're good at being politicians. We should always keep that in mind.
So when the United States is pondering some military action, and there are a lot of people calling for military action with respect to Russia as we record this. What should Americans keep in mind before they decide, yes, this is a good move and we ought to do it?
You should probably keep in mind that basically how the information landscape is shaped by concentrated interests. So people who report who report on foreign policy, they are generally close to the government. They get ahead because they're often given access and they're given scoops and often classified information. I mean, this is the norm in foreign policy reporting, and also that there's a lot of money going into think tanks, a lot of money going into activism that comes from concentrated interests, including weapons manufacturers, and they hire people in the government who just retired, as whether in the military or civilians who had a prominent role to play in foreign policy. So it's hard to, it's hard for people to know what to think of any particular issue because they have no firsthand experience with North Korea or Russia or Ukraine or any of this. These are just sort of abstract concepts. There are names that come up in the press and politicians talk about them. So it's really hard to know. But I mean, I think you should go through everything with the understanding that the information sort of landscape is biased in a certain direction.
Yeah. And you're talking about how the media discusses war and the options when the United States is considering going to war. You make mention in one of your chapters about the Washington Post in 2019 releasing thousands of pages. It came to be known as the Afghanistan Papers. It's now a book. I was stunned by really how little coverage that those papers generated.
Yeah, I mean the Washington Post is an interesting case because they have a lot of people who are close to the national security bureaucracy. Their op-ed pages are very, very hawkish. I mean, they have these conservatives like, Jed Rubin, they have Max Boot on there. I mean, these neocons, that's their conservative representation, and their liberals are all pretty much liberal hawks too. And the straight reporters like Bob Woodward, they tend to reflect David Ignatius, they tend to reflect the views of the foreign policy establishment. So a very hawkish paper, but they do great reporting too, and they released the Afghanistan Papers, there was a book based on it that came out last year, by Craig Whitlock, and I reviewed it for Reason Magazine. In my circles it got a lot of attention. How much attention did it get relative to, say, Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan, which led to American troops dying, and how much coverage did that get compared to the casualties of the year, the 20 years of the war before, and compared to the what's going on in Afghanistan now, which is starving because of American sanctions? Yes, it's very selective. I mean, partly the media is following, I mean, politicians. I mean, the Republicans are the opposition to Biden. And unlike on most issues, the media will give sort of the Republican view, sort of, a full airing on foreign policy, because the media is more sympathetic towards us hawkish foreign policy than they are towards anything else that might be called conservative. So basically, the Republicans, went crazy over the Afghanistan withdrawal, a lot of resistance within the bureaucracy, within the administration, and the media, which was sort of fertile ground for that. And then everything that doesn't help the pro-war agenda, whether it's the Afghanistan papers, whether it's the civilian casualties. I mean, the U.S. response to the attack from ISIS in Afghanistan, killed a bunch of civilians, and that got covered by like the Times. They did good journalism, like these journalistic institutions do, but nothing compared to the supposed disaster of withdrawal. So yeah, even if all the information is out there, the way it's presented and sort of where the emphasis is put is just always shaped in a certain direction.
I want to reframe an earlier question. What is a broadly held view, either among foreign policy elites or the reporters who cover foreign policy, or just the broad public that probably doesn't follow this as closely as you would, or as reporters would, or foreign policy experts would? What is a broadly held belief that you would argue is just not true, and it gives us incorrect conclusions when it comes to decisions about war and peace?
Yeah, I mean that's a great question. So I think one of them is that the U.S. is basically an upholder of international stability. I mean, if you look at the last 20 years, the U.S. has either started or supported a civil war in at least half a dozen countries in the Middle East. I mean, you have Afghanistan, you have Iraq, you have Libya, which we these places sometimes had conflicts before, but the U.S. just poured gasoline on the fire, just removed the government in Libya, replaced it with nothing. And like, why would you think that would end up being good? I mean, that often ends up being terrible. Trying to overthrow the government in Syria. I mean, there's no country in the world that really is such a force for instability like the U.S. is. And that's also based on the sanctions regime. So like when Russia will, invade a country or will interfere in their domestic politics, that happens too. Russia has, and Russia probably is, or is responsible for pouring gas on the fire in one civil war in the Ukraine. But the U.S. has done it several times. And so I think if you're going to say, who's basically worse for international stability, it's the U.S. And that's not even including the sanctions regime, where the U.S. shuts off countries from the entire global economy with the goal of regime change, with basically the goal that the people will rise up. And it never happens. I mean, but that's sort of, that sort of civil war is sort of the goal. I mean, it's pretty crazy. And so there's that. I think that there's another important thing is there is a sense that the U.S. is like just so morally superior to its to its adversaries. And so, I think the idea is even if we get people to acknowledge that the Afghanistan war was a disaster, the Iraq war was a disaster, sanctions are, bad and they have massive humanitarian effects, I think people are under the impression, the government means well, and these are just sort of naive mistakes. And if you're going to say that about the U.S., you could say that about Russia or China. They see things from their own perspective, and they think they're doing the right thing for their country. And so if they do bad things, and we say sometimes they make evil decisions, I think we have to look at the U.S. the same way. And so if you judge, I think by harm actually done, I think American foreign policy, I really think there's no competition with any other country of the last several decades.
Richard Hanania is author of Public Choice Theory and the Illusion of Grand Strategy. Subscribe to and give a rating to the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.